Hello all, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week style podcast. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. Today we're going to continue discussing Roberto Bolaño's posthumous epic, 2666. Last episode, we discussed the first section, called The Part About the Critics. Today we're talking about sections 2 and 3, called respectively The Part About Amalfitano and The Part About Fate. The part about Amalfitano is short. Amalfitano is a professor of philosophy at the University of Santa Teresa who lives with his daughter, Rosa, and he's having an existential crisis. He may even be going mad. A significant portion of his section concerns the madness of Rosa's mother, who abandoned them both when Rosa was just a child. Not a lot happens plot-wise in Amalfitano's section of the novel. The information that we're getting has far more to do with ideas and vibes. Amalfitano's floundering, hearing voices, consumed with terror for the safety of his daughter because of the killings that have been going on, and is deeply disturbed by a nameless dread that seems to permeate his life in Santa Teresa. The stress causes him to behave in irrational ways. He finds and hangs a text on geometry from a tree in his yard. He draws shapes and labels their vertices for different philosophical figures. He hears and speaks with a disembodied, homophobic voice, alternately purporting to be his grandfather and his father, who are both dead. The section follows and terminates on a more thoughtful arc, and I think it's more or less transparent what it's doing. It's telling us about madness as the true baseline for how we experience and make meaning out of reality. I'll be curious to hear if you guys have different takes than that. Amalfitano is terrified for his daughter's safety in the city where women are murdered once a week, and he's thinking about the madness of Rosa's mother as he himself goes insane. And the thing about it is that he is kind of grateful to be losing his mind. The part about Fate, the section after Amalfitano's, follows a black journalist named Fate working for a black culture Harlem magazine. We follow him from the death of his mother through research for a profile piece on one Barry Seaman, a former Black Panther turned chef and public speaker. Eventually, Fate is assigned to fill in for the recently deceased sports writer of the magazine and is sent to cover a boxing match in Santa Teresa. The boxing match is not important at all. I think 2666 does this at least twice, if not more. In the first section, we come to Santa Teresa looking for Archimbaldi, but never find him. And now we go to Santa Teresa for a boxing match. But when we finally get to the match, it's only a sentence or two. It doesn't really take long to cover that match. What is important about Fate's section is his earnest and refreshing interest in what the hell is going on in Santa Teresa. Fate both gives a shit and has the capacity to do something, though not very much. As he learns about what is going on in Santa Teresa, he even argues as much to his editor. He wants to cover that instead of the fight because the killings matter and the fight doesn't. Fate meets Rosa Amalfitano, the daughter of the subject of the previous section, through a journalist and the journalist's circle in Santa Teresa. Fate and Rosa bond when escaping a very nasty situation at a party after the boxing match. Enough bad shit goes down that they worry that they may now be hunted by either a gang or the police. It wasn't really clear to me what they were worried about, but Rosa's father sends her with Fate to cross the border into the U.S., and to an airport to fly to Barcelona because Santa Teresa is too dangerous. On their way out of Mexico, they accompany one other journalist, acquaintance of Fate's, on her way to interviewing the primary suspect in the killings, who's in jail and has been in jail for years, and the killings keep going on, and we're going to be teasing out the paradox of that in the next section of the novel. In a final wink to the darkness that we have coming for us in section 4, the part about the crimes, which we'll be covering in the next episode, the book cuts off as the suspected serial killer enters the room. So, questions. Amalfitano equates perception itself. Well, before we jump into that, Patrick, this is your first time with 2666. What are you like? This is a very shaggy novel, and you know, without having gotten to parts 4 and 5 now, we're at an interesting point where like we have opened up a lot of questions, but I don't know that we've answered them. What are you feeling just if and you could say that this is not a fair question, but like what are you feeling at this point in the novel reading it?
I would say about the time that Fate in part 3 discovers the killings and starts to get interested and has a conversation with his editor over the phone about why he should cover it. The fight's not important. This is the real story. Like around that time, I start to get pretty interested. Like I'm not saying I was never interested during parts 1 and 2, but it was more of a off and on type of thing. Like I thought that. Like I did especially like the like dialogue that Amalfitano seemed to have with his homophobic ancestor ghost, and I liked like how the ghost was like, you know, life, everything in life lets you down, and then Amalfitano lists a bunch of things, and the ghost is like, yep. Pretty much, yep. Like Amalfitano just keeps listing things.
Like love.
Love lets you down. Yeah. You know, I thought that was pretty funny. And also, like, you know, like darkly humorous, right? Because it's obviously fairly depressing stuff when you think about, you know, which is actually my favorite pessimist philosopher, David Benatar. He says, you know, if you believe in pessimistic ideas, you actually either have to laugh at them or not really think about them. That's all you could really do. You know, so I kind of like that. But I wouldn't say like I really understood like your question. I didn't see the idea, like I'm not saying it's not real. I think you're probably right. I just didn't quite see that Amalfitano equates perception with madness. Like I didn't understand that was the point of the section. I don't know why. Maybe I just didn't get it. Maybe like my mind wandered too much. I'm not sure. So, you know, I believe my feelings are interested. I am interested to kind of see what happens, but I don't know. I'm also interested, but dubious. Not necessarily dubious about anything in particular, which I know is a weird thing to say. Like I'm just feeling interested and dubious at the same time.
I mean, let me jump in real quick, because I think it's fair to feel like Bolaño. So the reason that I asked that question, which I, you know, of you, Patrick, which I didn't really have written down, is, you know, these were potentially going to be published as separate, you know, pieces, separate works. And I'm really glad that they aren't. But like we talked about with when we talked about the first section, because that was on the table, but because Bolaño even really wanted it that way, though perhaps more for financial than aesthetic reasons, I think it's fair to consider them as pieces and as a whole. I think it's a useful sort of craft question, because I really do. It's kind of interesting because I think, like, taken as pieces, I think each of them is very impressive on a craft level and interesting, but not like, they don't have the same ambition or reach as they have together. But it feels like Bolaño is asking a lot of readers to, like, read this as one big, like, novel with these multiple sections too. So it's, I guess, like, when we're talking about it in pieces, like today we're talking about sections 2 and 3, I'm curious about the experience of reading it, since it's kind of hard you really can't have that conversation if you're talking about the whole novel together, you know, all 1100 pages or whatever. So I want to take advantage of this, you know, opportunity to, like, reflect on what that experience is.
Well, one part of the experience that I wanted to add that I was thinking about as you were kind of, you know,
rambling.
Not rambling, but explaining, was that both you and Hans, I believe you said you're glad that it came out all as one. And, like, I don't necessarily have an opinion on that yet because I haven't finished it, but I so far, I don't feel like I'm reading a novel so much as a series of stories with overlapping characters that happen to occur in Santa Teresa, at least the last two, and the first one kind of ends in Santa Teresa. And, like, I've never read Jesus' Son, but everyone I've ever heard about who talks about Jesus' Son says it's like, is it a novel? Is it a book of stories with interrelations and all that? So I'm leaning, you know, right now I'm leaning towards interrelated stories right now. But of course, you know, you can't really tell until you get to the end. So that's like a part of what you're talking about, like wanting to get at the experience of someone who is reading it for the first time and hasn't finished it.
How do I feel about the first three sections of the novel? I mean, I think that you're both right in a way, right? I mean, I think that, like, your point, Chris, is that they need each other in some sense to function as a more complete work of art. And I do definitely think that's true. I mean, I went into this, sections 2 and 3 are probably the parts of the book that I have thought about the least over the years. They're the parts that I focused on the least when I was analyzing it when I was younger. And so I was interested in considering them in isolation. And there are things that I like about both of them, but I do think that they need the whole context of the book, I think, to work fully as in the ways that we can talk about them working in the context of the book, right? I think that was your point, Chris, that they, I hate that phrase more than the sum of its parts, right? Because that's such a cliche, and it's something that I think a lot of the time is used to describe things where there's an aesthetic effect that's somewhat inexplicable, right? But I think, like, this is a very classic example of that, or I think will be, you know, when we're discussing it in totality at the end. I like the two parts quite a lot. This is an interesting book, I think, in a way, because it is both, well, leaving aside the question of plot, right? Like, it's not something that you're necessarily going to read for the satisfaction of a conventional suspense plot, right? And I do think that that's thematically an aspect of what Bolaño is doing, is playing with the idea that sometimes knowing the answer to a thing is not satisfying in the way that we hope it will be, right? In part one, you know, there's a big plot question that hangs over the whole of part one, right? Who will Liz settle with? And we get an answer, and the answer is unsatisfying, right? There's a big question in part one, who really is Archimboldi, and will the critics ever know? And we will learn that, and I would say that we'll not find that satisfying in the manner that we might have imagined it would be in a different book, right? Who will win this boxing match? Well, the answer is unsatisfying. We are given the answer, right? I think actually, from a plot standpoint, the book, the individual sections and the book as a whole, both, it will even, I would argue, like the big question is who is killing these women, right? That's kind of like the big mystery. It will even answer that, I believe, to the extent that that is answerable, and it will be disappointing. A spoiler alert, I guess, right? But I mean, I do think that it is there. It does, in fact, in a way, like pose answers and resolutions to the things that we are presented with as questions. Right? It's not like, oh, I don't know, like Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Right? Like that's a 1,000-page novel that ends right at the point that the action is about to start happening. And you don't know in Infinite Jest what happens to the characters or what the resolution is of all these dangerous, violent events that are being built up and built up and built up, right? And I think that that is much more, that's different from what's happening here, right? In Infinite Jest, we truly don't know. Here, there's a kind of deflating effect in finding out the answers to what we thought we wanted to know. And so I think it's probably not, I don't know that it's accurate to say that it doesn't offer conventional plot satisfactions. I do think that it's accurate to say that it deflates those in a pretty interesting way. That aside, though, you know, it has an interesting, these first three sections really have kind of an effect where they are both messy and in some ways thematically actually very precise and open, right? I don't think that this is, thinking about something like Underworld, right? Like, we think of Underworld as a messy book. But Underworld is messy. And with Underworld, like, we left Underworld saying, well, like, what is DeLillo saying about the nature of memory? What is DeLillo saying about the things we suppress? What is DeLillo saying about garbage as a metaphor for suppressed trauma, right? We know that those ideas are in play, but we don't know, you can't really boil them down to a thesis statement, right? There's a passage in the part about Fate where Fate, if I remember right, he's sitting in a restaurant and he's listening to an investigator from America talk about the crimes and the city. And the investigator, if I'm remembering this correctly, the investigator says something about, like, he makes the comparison to, you know, French society, where all of French society would be scandalized by one person murdering his wife, and it would be like this enormous sensation. And meanwhile, thousands of people are dying in the colonies, right? But there are people who are inside and outside of society. And that the deaths of people inside society matter, the deaths of people outside of society don't. And that everyone in the city of Santa Teresa, aka Juarez, is outside of society. They are all Christians in an ancient Roman amphitheater, and that they'd all be better off to just walk into the desert, right? And get the fuck out of there. And that basically, like, that is, there is no ambiguity in that, and that pretty much is like a big flashing sign of the ideas of the book, the social critique of the book, right? So I don't think that it, I think it is actually a thematically very, like, very straightforward to the point of unsubtle kind of book, and I do think that it establishes answers to the questions it sets up, right? Now we can talk at the end about how satisfying those are. But reading these two sections, I did start to think, you know, I think in some ways it is both incredibly it's both incredibly messy and in certain ways unsatisfying, but I think in other ways deceptively straightforward and plain spoken, right? It is both the contrast between, you know, if you think about like the Amalfitano section, I don't know what the point is of that, right? I like your thesis, Chris. I like what you suggested. I don't know that I can endorse it as something I found there, right? And I don't even know, you did a better job actually of pulling a coherent idea out of it than I did. But to a great extent, I do think that like, I have always just read the Amalfitano section as much as anything as just kind of like atmosphere, right? You know, you have this person who has a who probably has had a difficult life and a sad life and kind of always a somewhat frail grasp on reality. And something about the kind of aura of Santa Teresa finally pushes him over into madness, you know? And so much of the first three sections is about like the aura, the mood of Santa Teresa, right? Santa Teresa, I think I used this metaphor in the last episode, but as this kind of giant dark shape under the water coming toward you inexorably, or, you know, like a train coming out of the fog, right? And it doesn't really, I don't know that it does much besides create an atmosphere and kind of establish that vibe. But then, you know, in the part about fate, you have this incredibly straightforward thesis just being delivered mouthpieced by a character, you know? So I think it's a very interesting book in the sense that it has like these little pockets of extreme straightforwardness mixed into these kind of big, mushes of vibe and atmosphere. And that is, you know, conventionally not good writing, but, you know, for me, I think that like the mood, the atmosphere, the dark humor, some of the kind of subtleties of the character beats, the ways that it is suspenseful when it is suspenseful, right? Like the fate section does actually have a certain kind of propulsion to it. Those things are effective enough that reading these two parts, my thought was like, I can see why somebody might regard this as not playing by the rules, but I'm fond enough of the bits that I can forgive the ways in which either they, not that they don't hold together, but that they actually hold together in a very graceless and unsubtle way that requires forgiving a certain amount of haphazardness or over obviousness mixed with over enigmaticness. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, but that's like every thought that I had about the book in the whole last 2 weeks.
No, well, I really appreciate you putting words to this because, you know, I believe, I don't know if you said his name, but there's a Professor Kessler that Fate overhears who I think says that he's the one who says those lines about, you know, everyone. Or no, does he say? Yeah, he's the one who says those lines. And Barry Seaman has a very long section that is, or not long, very long, but like a pretty sizable section where he's sort of rambling on, at times sort of like, you know, enigmatic in a way where you wonder like if there's anything there or if he's if he's just kind of an old coot, and then other times like seemingly very erudite and in a way that is sort of on the nose. And I didn't think about the kind of balance of very very transparent, like at times ideas, you know, saying the quiet part out loud, which, you know, generally like, you don't, you try to not do. And then kind of veiling that in very kind of indeterminate, nondescript, layered gray of vibe and dread. And somehow all of that working, or at least for it sounds like you, and it does work. It does work for me too. It's me more stepping out of the experience. You know, I did going from section two to section three. I was like, what? This time, like, you know, but it was brief and I was immediately back into it. But, you know, it works for me, but in stepping out of it, and thinking about it, I can see why, you know, like people could be very frustrated with this novel, for not following the rules, like you said. But I really appreciate you kind of laying that out. Like, it is this kind of strange blend of extremely transparent about what it's about, and then not super transparent about, like I don't really know what Rosa and Fate are running from at the end of the part about Fate. Maybe you guys have a better idea. It's like they had a very, very unpleasant, near violent experience at Charlie Cruz, his house. And then there's a police officer outside of their house, and Amalfitano is kind of vague in his assessment of the situation, but really says that they need to get out. And I can't tell if Amalfitano is like taking advantage of their fear to drive Rosa out of Santa Teresa, or if there's really is like some police conspiracy or you know, Charlie Cruz or Chucho are like connected in some way. I was really unclear plot-wise exactly what was going on there, even if thematically I feel like I had a much better idea of what, you know, what both Amalfitano's section and Fate section at least are saying for me. But do either of you have an idea of what's happening there plot-wise, and does it connect back to like what this novel is doing?
Well, I think that plot-wise, there are loose, because of the corruption, the combination of corruption and poor governance, the city of Santa Teresa, like the cartels, the media, and the police and the local government are all in some sense kind of the same thing. Right? Like they're somewhat distinct, but they bleed together pretty strongly at the edges and don't directly coordinate with each other, but kind of share interests. And the boundaries between them are looser than one would hope, right? So upsetting someone like Chucho Flores is not the same as directly upsetting the cartel or directly upsetting the police, but it is kind of it's uncomfortably proximate to doing so. And they don't really, they know that, but they don't really understand exactly what the connections are, right? And I think the uncertainty that we have as readers about exactly what there is to be scared of or what they think is going to happen, presumably, like, they do in fact share that, right? They don't really know exactly how connected A to B to C are between, you know, Chucho and the cartels and the police, but they're presumably at least somewhat connected and have some influence on each other. And I think that the amorphousness of what the threat is, I think, in fact, a reflection of kind of the amorphousness of like how power actually works in a place where authority is so broken down and corrupted by crime.
The man with the mustache is sort of like the dude in the man with the mustache at Charlie Cruz's house is a bit like the dude in the bear suit in The Shining, where it's just sort of like, who's the guy in the mustache? And I can't tell if there is a maybe a maybe it is the kind of paranoia of being in Santa Teresa where, you know, it feels like an unsaid thing or underexplored thing that we're going to get into it in part four, I know, that the number one suspect for the killings has been in prison for a while and the killings keep on happening. And, you know, whether this is something that is perpetuated by a group of people, whether there is some kind of conspiracy that is eating up like foreign journalists, whether there is a cover up, you know, who to trust. And it feels, even if, it feels almost like maybe this is an angle, the personal experience, the personal sort of emotional experience of this dreadful place is very transparent and lifted up and clear. But the nature of the context itself is extremely unclear. And it's part of what fosters that very true personal reaction to Santa Teresa. So, like, you know, I don't think Amalfitano is confused about his feelings about Santa Teresa. You know, I think that he's, I think that the what is mysterious is exactly what, you know, what the fuck is going on, and like how that may be connected to all these other like forms of power in Santa Teresa that seem, you know, seem like they're either feckless or unconcerned or directly involved somehow. Patrick, you mentioned spending the first part of Fate with Barry Seaman, and Fate, you know, Fate's mother dies too at the very beginning of that section. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, it sounded like you didn't really know what to do with all of that. Like, this isn't attacking the book. I think that the book is fucking great and can withstand some criticism. But, like, you know, at this point, you're like, how about we cut to Santa Teresa? Fate going to Santa Teresa. Why do we have, I mean, at least, is it half of Fate's section, again, that is not in Santa Teresa? But you're feeling at this point like checked out when we're not really near the locus at the center of this novel.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of stuff is hard for me because one, like, I don't want to categorically say anything about like being too far away from the locus of a novel. You know, like, I used to argue with my coworker at Cincinnati State in the Writing Center about Moby Dick. I'd be like, man, Moby Dick rules. And he'd be like, it could have used an editor. And I'm like, what would you cut, moron? You know, like, right? And he's like, the parts you like, you know, where, like, there are chapters on cytology, you know, the homily from the preacher, which is, like, awesome, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't want to be, like, you know, I don't want to be, like, you know, I'm, Roberto Bolaño needed an editor or anything like that. I guess it's just like, whereas I totally see why we need the part in Moby Dick where Pip gets stranded out in the ocean for hours and then comes back like his soul is gone, like he's a ghost of a person. Like, I get why we need that, but I don't get why we need, you know, the Black Panther guy, Barry Seaman. And it's probably because there's no real answer why we need Barry Seaman or Pip. It's just that, like, the Pip part of Moby Dick strikes a chord with me that I think is fantastic and wouldn't want to lose, whereas the Barry Seaman part doesn't. Like, you know, Starlight and Semblances, like, I remember reading that part, the Semblances part, and thinking, well, is he doing some kind of, like, postmodern bit about, like, there not being, like, to my mind, words and symbols like words approximate reality, and some approximate it better than others. Whereas to what I take as the postmodern position is that that words, there is no, something like there is no reality and words construct reality, or words created, or something like that. So if Barry Seaman, the Semblances thing, is doing something like postmodern like that, I'm not, that's not going to strike a chord with me. But it's not to say that it doesn't make sense to someone else. And if it makes sense to someone else, okay.
But this is maybe my last question. How does one earn that kind of shagginess, right? So is there a craft aspect to shagginess? Because we talk about, like, you know, it was a previous episode, like, Hans, I think you were the one to say that, like, novels are often a little bit Frankenstein monstered from, you know, maybe a bunch of shit that the author has been noodling on for a while and writing potentially in different directions that kind of come together. You know, Patrick, you mentioned Jesus' Son. I think that, if I remember right, that was written as a collection of short stories, but those short stories, you know, more or less concern the same character, and at different points in his life, and sort of fuse or synergize into something that is recognizable as like a compendium, if not a novel. And if an author, if it's sort of common for, or at least not uncommon for authors who are especially working on larger works to fill that space with exploration that, mm-hmm. that isn't like necessarily like driving the plot forward, what are the craft considerations that go into like making good choices when doing that? Like, well, how do you do a good job of that? Because it feels a bit like, you know, you're sort of, are you really at the mercy of the final reader and their taste, or are there things in your control to justify the kind of meandering?
Well, you can. One thing that's that Bolaño has going for him is like humorousness, like strength of thought. You know, he knows how to, like, construct interesting scenarios and interesting characters to populate those scenarios. So like there are probably what a to just from my perspective, there are probably good rules of thumb when you're being Shaggy, like having good scenarios and good characters that will generally speak to more readers, though you won't catch all readers, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like a baseline, I would say, to like, if you're gonna write a huge Shaggy novel, then having a good voice, having interesting characters, things like that, is at least a good baseline, and then you'll be closer to successful, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of this novel, having a certain level of moral seriousness helps, right? Like, because there are, and you know, I mean, that's not something that we have a full sense of with the part that we've read so far, but in, part one, I think we've talked before about, like, the, particularly the Gonzalez's treatment of the rug vendor, right? Or maybe I got the Spanish critic. I can't remember what his last name is, but
Espinoza.
Espinoza, not Gonzalez.
But yeah.
Espinoza's treatment of the teenage rug vendor, right? There's like a way that is, that poses, I wouldn't say poses a moral question exactly, but there's like a kind of a way that there's an emotional and a moral provocation in that suggests that there is a real kind of depth of moral thinking or a kind of emotional seriousness at the heart of the shagginess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the preoccupation with murder, the bits of like Kessler's observation, those show that there is some kind of a purpose here beyond just kind of shagginess for its own sake, right? Which is very, very different from a lot of kind of classically postmodern novels that are just entirely shagginess for its own sake. Like, I don't know, like, this isn't something any of us have read for the podcast, but Mulligan Stew by Gilbert Sorrentino or something like that, that's just like entirely devoid of that kind of core and almost kind of mocks the idea of having that kind of a core, right? In a way, this is not at all, I mean, I think a lot of what gets called postmodern literature is not postmodern in the classical sense, but this is particularly not postmodern in the classical sense, just to the extent that it has a kind of core of ideas and a certain kind of ethical.
Yeah.
That's very different.
I would think having a moral core is kind of anathema to a truly postmodern book.
Yeah.
So relative to a lot of like self-indulgent experimental literature, this is a different animal in that regard,
Right.
And I think, humor, you already mentioned humor, Patrick, but rereading this, I'd been describing, I think I might've said this exact thing when we were discussing part one, but I had been describing this book to a couple people ahead of the podcast, and I would talk about it with someone and I just think like, wait, do I like this book? This sounds kind of dreadful. But it's never not a little bit funny, right? And almost, and even, I mean, we're about to go into the bleakest, darkest, nastiest part of the whole book. But, I'm about 10 pages in.
God.
And once again, it's actually quite frequently darkly funny, much more so than you would expect just given what's happening, right? So I think those help a lot. You can, if you have fundamentally good prose, if you have interesting, arresting images, like the dreams in part one, right? Like not much, not much happens that's visually interesting in part one, but there are these dream sequences that really kind of add imagistic depth. You mean
part two with the Mafitano?
No, the critic's dreams in part one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd already forgotten about them because Amalfitano has some dreams too.
Amalfitano has some dreams too. Yeah. But
Boris Yeltsin.
Exactly. I do just, this is a little bit back up a little bit, but I just wanted to think a little bit, you know, we were talking a little bit about the first half of part three, the first half of the Fate part, and whether or not, you know, his mother's death and the magazine work and the Barry semen, do those have any kind of a point? I think, you know, when you look at how Fate behaves once he's in Santa Teresa, there's an interesting quality he has of kind of like incompetence and hypercompetence, right? A way mm-hmm. that he kind of can carry himself and navigate while also, I mean, he thinks at some point like, oh my God, I've been so foolish, because he's kind of just casually launched himself into this world where he's, he ends up, you know, interacting with some very dangerous people and not really understanding the gravity of it until later, but also kind of behaves and speaks periodically in a pretty intelligent way and can carry himself effectively. And that, I think if we didn't spend a certain amount of time with him understanding who he is and what world he comes from, I think that would seem harder to swallow or stranger or maybe less plausible, right? Like the portrait we get in the first half is of this person who, you know, comes from this relatively hard background, has acquired this kind of intelligent skill set as a writer and a thinker, and has, you know, been through this experience of grief, which seems to have put him into a little bit of a daze and made him act in these irrational ways, right? And who is mm-hmm. kind of like already living in this way where he's like, you know, he seems dedicated to his work as like a social cause, but is spending a lot of time, you know, profiling, interacting with these people who kind of are nuts, right? And presumably is at least somewhat tired of that. So I guess I thought of the first half as being, I mean, in just the most classic sense, right? Like establishing character, you know, establishing character in ways that make the action then make sense. Now, there is kind of an odd asymmetry structurally, right, where we take, you know, instead of spending a bit of time establishing a character, which we then follow through an extended scenario, we, because of the sort of the compression of the section, we end up having almost like 50-50 between setup and payoff in a way, right? So I don't know that, I mean, I can see that it's not classically balanced in how it's used, but I had thought of that as I was reading it as being the purpose of that section.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up his competence, because it is striking and surprising when he saves Rosa, and that feels like the kind of a story beat or a plot point in a much more plot-driven type of story that you know, like we haven't gotten so far. There's a propulsiveness at that point that is like very, very different, and he's castigating himself for being stupid enough to put them both in that situation. But you know, he, you know, it's a, I don't know if it works as a standalone piece. And so I think it's great, but I also am still very glad that it's part of something larger. And, we'll start talking about the whole thing together in the next episode. Patrick, have you started reading part four yet?
No. We're going to meet again in 2 weeks, and it doesn't take me that long.
Buckle up, Buttercup. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I've read some pretty disturbing novels.
What's the most disturbing, like, what are the disturbing novels that pop into your head?
I would say at the very top of the list, Like, if I had a lot of time to think about it, maybe this wouldn't make the top of the list. But Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy is, like, so disturbing and horrifying. And unlike this book, has no sense of humor whatsoever, you know, which, you know, doesn't bother me. But it, of course, for you guys, it would probably be a big downer. There are other things to think about in Blood Meridian, but just so much violence and you know, apocalyptic just racism, and it's a pretty horrifying novel that I also think is a masterpiece and effing wonderful and great. But yeah, man. So I'm curious if like the horrifyingness of this section, or I don't know if it's both sections 4 and 5 or just section four.
Four is really hard.
Yeah.
For me.
I don't know if it'll top Blood Meridian or not, but I'll let you know when we like Blood Meridian genuinely made me feel uncomfortable. So we'll see if this genuinely makes me feel uncomfortable. Well, maybe it will.
I'm trying to think of the most disturbing thing book that we've done for the podcast. Is it like The Wasp Factory?
That's pretty, oh man, that's pretty disturbing.
That's a pretty disturbing book. I don't know what else would be.
What about that one novel where a dude fucks a giant worm?
that one, I mean, that one's kind of, that one has great humor in it.
Yeah.
To kind so of,
maybe it's not
the levity.
Yeah, that one gave me the warm fuzzies.
Did it?
yeah. No, good point though, Patrick. Good point.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, The Wasp Factory was pretty disturbing.
Yeah, and your Hans, book, you and, pervert. And
Lavona, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah.
Vera, what was it, the right before The Wasp Factory, we read the Gore Vidal book, Myra Breckinridge. Some of that was fairly disturbing.
Yeah, we read
it's
two
relatively
of those.
Subtle ones, you know.
Yeah.
We read, yeah. That was disturbing. Like the ending where like the guy who is probably gay or, no, he's not gay. Where Myra, I guess that's a big spoiler for people who haven't read it. So I won't get into it, but yeah.
Anything else on sections 2 and 3 of 2666? All right. Thank you everyone for listening. Join us next time for the conclusion of our coverage on Belerto Rabano. Is that how you said his name earlier, Patrick?
Yeah,
Belerto Rabano's.
Yeah, I was chanting it at work. Belerto Rabano.
2666.
Even though it's Roberto Bolaño, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us.